Hello and welcome to the Good Old Days of Radio Show. Yep, it's Thursday. And yep, we are doing Escape. And yep, we have Keith Scott back with us. I feel like Dave Hester on Storage Wars. Yep. The young people in the audience will know what that refers to. Anyway, I have my own storage wars going on right here. We have a lot of things to store and no place to store it anymore. Anyway, welcome back to the Good Old Days of Radio Show, Keith Scott.
That's a pleasure.
Live from Australia, where it's early in the morning and it's later in the afternoon here as we're doing this. But you've kindly consented to do 10 of these in a row. Man, what a run. And of course, this is the episode number 10. This is our last one. I'm sure that we'll do something further with Keith in the future, and we'll discuss that with him whenever we get around to that. But anyway, in the meantime, we are on episode 10 of Escape. This one from 1954. Wow, this is going to be from right near the end of the run. It's August 1954. Right. So obviously they were doing high-quality episodes of Escape right up to the very end. It's called Two and Two Make Four. I know nothing about this. So before we hear it, Keith, what should we know about it?
Well, this, as you say, was near the end of the run. I really, in the previous nine, concentrated on the first 3 years of Escape because I wanted to demonstrate just what high quality adaptations they did from famous, you know, spy and adventure stories. And I think we covered that pretty comprehensively. But this, there's often a feeling that by 54, when everything was a tape operation and the actors were, the shows were pre-recorded, they didn't go out live, although this one did, but a lot of them by then were being pre-recorded, that by then, you know, with the music cues definitely being pre-recorded and assembled later after the actors were recorded, the shows of that era in 54 were a bit sterile sounding, but not so. You get a show like this one, and again, it's one of those just fanciful tales that was written by Walter Brown Newman, who wrote the very first ever Gunsmoke radio show and many other excellent radio shows, including a brilliant suspense episode called 3 o'clock with Van Heflin.
Oh, I know that one. We featured that when we had Joe Webb on the show.
That's right.
And that's a classic. Surprised me because I'd never heard it before, and I thought it was just outstanding.
Yeah, well, he was, as Norman MacDonald refers to him on, I think, the Gunsmoke documentary. He said Walter Newman was one of the better writers in town. And by then, also, Norman MacDonald had left Escape to concentrate more on the Gunsmoke radio show because the TV show was gearing up, the Gunsmoke TV show. So he was way too busy. And he handed Escape over for the last several shows to the team of Mort Fine and David Friedkin, who'd been writing as a team every episode of Broadway Is My Beat and all of these sorts of things, and many, many great suspense shows. And they became the producer-directors by this point, as Escape was winding up its contract. I think it had six more weeks to go, and then that was it. It was replaced by the new series of sponsored Gunsmoke, when Gunsmoke was sponsored by L&M Filters. So this one is just one of those fun shows that again throws you into what is this mystery all about? You know, this merchant marine is going to jump on a ship in Calais in France, and he gets blackjacked. And when he wakes up, he discovers that he's not in France; he's in England, and that therein lies the mystery. And the lead is a very good actor called Shep Menken, who the younger people will probably remember years and years later. There was a long-running animated TV commercial campaign for Western Airlines, and he was this bird who said, "The only way to fly."
Oh, I remember that. I didn't know it was him, but okay.
Yeah. Well, he's the younger guy in this show in 54, and he plays the lead, this merchant marine guy who's just totally confused throughout the whole show, and the mystery unfolds, and you'll enjoy this because it is just such a convoluted little story.
All right. Well, with that, from August 21st, 1954, the CBS Radio Network, just as it's succumbing to the monster called television, we have Escape. 2 and 2 make 4.
Tired of the everyday grind? Ever dream of a life of romantic adventure? Want to get away from it all? We offer you Escape.
Escape, designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
You are running over the fog-locked cliffs of Dover. By your side, a girl who believes you are a madman. And pursuing you, bent on destroying you, a man whose terrible secret you've stumbled upon, and from whom there is no escape.
Listen now as Escape brings you Walter Brown Newman's story, 2 and 2 make 4.
Head hurt. I sat up and opened my eyes. Fog all around, thick and close and still. I could see trees and a few yards of dirt road. My watch was gone and my wallet. Rolled, slugged and rolled and dumped. But where? I scrambled to my feet and I stood there in the ditch, suddenly worried about the time. It would be bad to be late going aboard. As for the ship sailing without me, I stepped onto the road. Which way led back to Calais? Someone was coming. Hello?
Qui est là? Why don't you answer? I can't see. Oh!
Down the road, then across a field alongside a brook. I ran till I thought my lungs would burst. I stopped to listen, but the blood was pounding so I couldn't be sure I wasn't followed. I ran some more. The brook went under a small bridge. On it, leaning against the stone wall, looking down at me, was a girl with a knapsack on her back. I climbed up the bank. Mademoiselle, s'il vous plaît, mademoiselle...
I'm sorry, I don't speak French.
Did you hear those shots?
Shots?
A few minutes ago, right past my ear, almost blew my head off.
Well, you should tell the police or something. I have to be going. I have a long way to go.
No, wait a minute.
Sorry, I really
must... No, wait. What time is it, please?
Well, not quite 6:45. The way it looks now, we'll have fog at least until noon.
Noon? You mean it's 6:45 in the morning?
Well, yes, of course in the morning. Well, I've got to...
Hold on. Which way is Calais?
Calais? Well, that way, about 20 miles.
20? I've got to make my ship. You mind if I walk along with you?
Well...
My name's David Parker.
Mine's Haydock, Emily Haydock.
I'm in the Merchant Marine, second mate on a freighter. You want a walking trip or something?
That's right.
I figured. The knapsack. American?
Yes.
Me too. I thought you were French at first.
Why was that?
Took it for granted. Most people in France are.
Well, I don't understand. We're in England, not France. Why should you think that you...
What do you mean, England? Didn't you just tell me we were 20 miles from Calais?
Well, yes, but Calais is somewhere out there across the English Channel in France.
And where do you say we are, you and me, now?
In England, of course, about 2 miles from Dover.
Now, look. I've been robbed and dumped out here in the countryside and shot at, so please don't make jokes.
I'm not.
What's today, quick?
Thursday, 10th of July. Why?
Then we're in France.
Look, I tell you, we're
When
not...
I registered at the hotel in Calais last night, I noticed the date. It was the 9th of July.
Now, look... You asked me where we are, and I told you. England, near Dover.
I suppose I didn't see the sunrise in Calais just an hour ago.
Sunrise?
Sunrise, sunrise.
What sunrise? I've been up since 5. There's been no sun for a week. It's one of the worst fogs they've ever had.
Oh, drop it, drop it. I tell you, I saw it.
You're either joking or lying or crazy.
No, wait a minute. No more of that lying, that crazy, do you hear? No more of that crazy.
Well, what else am I to think when you say you were shot at and you saw the sun? Sun today. And you insist you're in France when you're in England.
All right, Miss Haydock. Turn around. Now, what do you see alongside the road?
Gate. Stone wall.
Yeah, and in front of the gate.
A mailbox. Why?
And what does it say on the mailbox? Villa Monbijou. I don't know what Bijou means, but it's French. French. What do you say now?
We're in England.
You don't know where to stop, do you? All right, all right. I'm going into this villa, whatever it is, and phone for a taxi to take me to my ship. I was going to offer you a lift, but now I'd sooner cut my tongue out. How do you like that?
Oh, go to the devil. You're in England!
Bonjour. Parlez anglais? D'anglais compris? Say, is there anyone here who speaks English?
I speak English.
Oh, good, good. May I use your phone to call a taxi?
Of course. Won't you come in?
Thanks. I have no money on me, Mr.
Putney. Dr. Putney.
I haven't a penny with me, doctor, but I'll be able to get some from the clerk at the hotel, and I'll send you whatever the call costs with the taxi driver.
Oh, not at all, not at all. There's the phone.
Thanks. Hello. Hello. Oh, come on.
Service is always a bit slow at this hour.
I'm sorry. The fact is, I got angry with a silly girl out on the road.
Did you?
Yeah, she tried to kid me. Well, the joke will be on her when she's trudging along the road and sees me riding in my ease to Calais. Oh, come on.
Riding to Calais?
In a taxi. I wouldn't have minded if she'd let the joke drop, but no, she went on and on about this being England and that I was crazy to think otherwise.
Well, I'm afraid I don't understand the joke. I mean, this is England.
Look, I don't find it funny, Doctor. I thought I made that clear. The next one who tells me I'm in England when I know I'm in France, I swear I'll take...
You know you're in France?
Yes. Yes.
Sit down, young man.
Isn't this France?
England. Near Dover. How can I show you? Here's a copy of the London Times, yesterday's.
Wednesday, July 9th. But the name on the mailbox, Villa Watsis, that's French.
Most of the villas have names like that. Montbijou, Sanssouci. Still, it's England. Sit down. I'm a physician, and I'd like to ask you...
Oh, no, no.
Young man! Young man!
Two and two make four. I repeated it like a charm, like they told me in the hospital. When you feel unsure of yourself, remember, two and two make four. There's an explanation for everything. Don't doubt yourself. After a while, I stopped trembling. I opened the gate and went out onto the road. And there was the girl.
Oh, everything all right?
Did you come back to say I told you so?
No, I... Well, I thought you might need help. I thought that...
Watch out, there's a truck coming.
Well, there's an inn just around the curve.
Get down, he might shoot you again. Get down.
Mr. Parker, please, that was a backfire, that's all it was.
Backfire?
Of course. What else could it be? There's an inn just around the curve, and I have money. Wouldn't you like to have breakfast there and talk?
Oh, I'm all confused.
Anyone would be after a blow on the head.
No, it's not just being slugged. I wish it were only that, but with a case like me that...
You're not a case.
Oh, that's just it. I am. About 6 weeks ago, unloading cargo, a crate hit me on the head, scrambled my memory. They sent me to the hospital, and the ship sailed without me. She's due back in Calais this afternoon. I was to report aboard if the treatment proved successful. They told me it was successful and discharged me yesterday. Maybe it wasn't yesterday and none of it happened and I'm imagining it all.
Now, try not to worry. It'll all come back to you.
Yeah, but suppose what comes back never really happened. That's the point, you see. That's the point. I remember a lot about yesterday, but what if I only think I remember and it's all
shh,
in my...
Shh. Now relax. We'll have breakfast in here. If you remember, you remember.
Yeah, yeah, but do I? I recall leaving the hospital and going to a hotel. Then I went to an all-night restaurant, and I remember leaving a bar at daybreak. Oh, sit down, Miss Haydock, please.
Thank you.
Yeah, I remember all that clearly. But an hour later, I'm in England, and that's impossible.
Well, you might have wandered aboard a channel steamer.
No, use your head. It's a 2 or 3 hour trip by boat.
Well, an airplane, then.
Oh, excuse me. I thought perhaps you'd like your coffee now while waiting for breakfast.
Yeah. Miss, is there an airfield nearby?
Oh, yes, sir, but it's not an object of interest for tourists today. Our churches is very nice, though.
How far away is it, the airfield?
Oh, you won't see no planes coming or going, sir. The BBC broadcast said no air traffic in or out of Dover for the 6th straight day. Oh, good morning, Mr. Smith Travers.
Breakfast, Rosie.
Yes, sir. Anything else for the present, sir?
No.
No air traffic 6 days in a row. You'd think that would teach them, but will it?
I beg your pardon.
I leave it to you. Is there any reason for maintaining this undependable method of transportation, a method absolutely at the mercy of the elements, when there's a cheaper, better, less bothersome, simpler, and always certain way of crossing the channel?
You mean the boats?
No, of course not. The tunnel, the channel, tunnel.
Tunnel?
Yes, of course. Rosie, I want coffee now.
Right, Mr. Smith Travers.
The channel tunnel. 20 miles through solid, impermeable chalk. In at Dover, out at Calais. Less than an hour's drive. No fuss.
I never heard of it. Is it something recent?
Recent? Oh, you're strangers here. Tourists, eh?
Yeah.
Well, you've heard of Napoleon Bonaparte.
Oh, yeah.
He had it dug by the 6th Corps of the Engineers of the Imperial Army. Took them 3 years. All done in secret, of course, for a surprise attack on England.
You mean to say there's actually a tunnel beneath the English Channel in use?
Certainly it's in use. I've been through it scores of times. Business, you know. Import-export. Just drove back from Kelly a few hours ago. Morning, Doctor.
Good morning, Smith Travers.
Just advising them to go by way of the tunnel if they want to get to Kelly.
Yes, of course. Much the best way.
Did it in 23 minutes this morning. New carburetor, you know. Well, good morning to you, sir. Liss.
I must have seemed like a lunatic, Doctor, not knowing I was in England. You see, I was in Calais, and an hour later I was in England, and I didn't understand how that was possible. I didn't know about the tunnel beneath the channel.
Try not to excite yourself, my boy. Everything will soon be all right.
What?
I've brought someone with me. Constable.
This poor fellow?
Poor fellow? You mean... Oh, you do think I... But I told you... I didn't know about the tunnel. I must have gone through the tunnel.
He didn't know until Mr. Smith Travers told him.
Yes, I heard. But Mr. Smith Travers is also of the firm conviction that we British are descended from the 10 lost tribes of Israel, that Shakespeare never existed, and that after a bit more research, we'll be able to transmute base metals into gold. We know him and like him and humor his eccentricities. Come along, Mr. Parker. I think it in the public interest that you not be on the public streets.
Yeah, come along.
No. Listen. I was in Calais at sunrise. I can prove it. I just remembered the name of the hotel. The Hotel de la Mar. Phone them and they'll tell you that there's a David Parker registered there. They have my passport at the desk.
Give me a good
Let
one,
me
now,
go.
You're hurting him, you big bully.
I was in Calais. I was. Two and two make four. Two and two make four.
You are listening to Two and Two Make Four, tonight's presentation of Escape. Keep listening for the climax in tonight's exciting story on Escape. And listen tomorrow for CBS Radio's exciting World Music Festivals concert. 3 excerpts from Alban Berg's tragic opera, Wojciech, will highlight the program. That's tomorrow, daytime, on most of these stations. And now back to Escape and the second act of Two and Two Make Four.
They took us to a room in the town hall. Dr. Putney, it turned out, was not only a physician, he was the local magistrate as well. For more than 3 hours, he questioned Miss Haydock and me in turn. He made us repeat our stories endlessly, where she met me, how I behaved, what I said, what she said, and all the rest of it. It was almost noon before he was finished. And watching the clock on the wall, my ship coming nearer to Calais with every tick, I was almost beside myself with anxiety.
You need care, my boy. Rest and help. Now, we've a fine institution in Folkestone near here which can give you that care. A few weeks, possibly days.
Institution?
Look, I've got to get to Calais.
Miss Haydock, will you try to convince him it's for the best?
There's nothing wrong with me.
I'll try once more to show you reality, Mr. Parker. You say you were in France at sunrise.
I do, I was.
And you insist you were in England an hour later.
Look, please, please, call the Hotel de la Mer in Calais. I checked in there. There's bound to be a record of it. That will prove I'm telling the truth.
And if the call is made and it doesn't prove you're telling the truth, will you take my advice about the institution?
Yes.
Constable, put through a call to the Hotel de la Mer in Calais.
Yeah, very good, sir.
Hello? If the hotel bears out Mr. Parker's story, you'll let him go?
Miss Haydock, if it turns out that Mr. Parker is right, but how could he be?
2 and 2 make 4. 2 and 2 make 4.
Oh, what's that?
I have the hotel, sir.
Use the constable's phone, Mr. Parker. I'll listen in on my extension.
Hello, desk clerk.
Hello. Hello.
Hello. Is there a Mr. Parker registered there? David Parker?
Parker? David Parker? Oh, oui, there was, but he has checked out since 2 hours ago.
But he, I mean, he couldn't have. You're mistaken.
Oh, no, sir, I am not. Not if you mean that Monsieur Parker is an American seaman. I returned his passport personally when he paid his bill. I have the...
I'm not even who I thought I was. All right, Dr. Putney, I'll go with you.
No, wait. Before you do, let me speak to you in private. Please.
May we, doctor? Would it be all right?
I'll give you 2 minutes. Constable, we can arrange for an ambulance to Folkestone.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Parker.
No, that's not my name.
2 and 2 make 4.
Yeah.
2 and 2 make 4.
Uh-huh.
You must have faith in yourself. If you're convinced you were in France one moment and in England an hour later, then that's the way it was.
But it's a physical impossibility.
No, it's not. You could have come through the tunnel.
There is no tunnel.
If a tunnel is the only explanation for what happened to you, then there is a tunnel. 2 and 2 make 4.
Yeah. You really believe my story?
I believe you.
All right, then. All right. What do I do now?
You tell me. Come on, you know the answer.
I find the man in the restaurant, the man who said there was a tunnel, Smith Travers.
Right. Open the window.
All right. I'll go first, and I'll help you down. Now, come on.
Okay. Here's my knapsack.
I got it. Got it. Now you.
Time's up, I'm afraid. Miss Haydock, come back here. Miss Haydock! Mr. X, whatever your name is. Constable, stop them!
I'll do my best, sir.
Fog hit us before we'd run 20 feet. We dodged around corners, then stopped at a garage and looked up Mr. Smith Travers' address in a directory. It proved to be a little villa like a dozen others I'd seen that day. There was no answer when we knocked at the door, so we waited. And before very long, Mr. Smith Travers drove up in a light truck.
Look, the valise I left at the hotel in Calais. He's got it.
Good afternoon. I'll take that.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, my passport, too, please.
I see you've concluded the tunnel does exist.
That's right.
Blast, you're the first to ever have. It's a bit of bad luck, for me, that is. If I hadn't hit a flat tire halfway through, the passport and valise would be in ashes by now.
You phoned the hotel in Calais.
Yes,
I thought you might. I heard you shouting at the inn about the hotel, so I drove over and...
Didn't it make you doubt your senses when they told you you checked out?
Oh, you have no idea.
Yes, I was counting on that.
Yeah, it rocked me, but only for a minute.
How the devil did you get in my machine in the first place?
Well, the way I figure, I was knocked on the head by some thug and robbed this morning in Calais. Whoever did it may have thrown me in your truck to get me out of sight.
I was never so surprised in my life. I mean to say, I skidded near Dover, sideswiped a tree, and heard the back door bang open. When I stopped and went back, there you were lying with a bolt of my silk in your arms. Took my breath away. When you started to groan and sit up, I was beside myself.
What's the matter?
It just occurred to me, you're not English. Bad thing to have someone not in the government and a foreigner to boot to know about the tunnel. Security, you know.
Do you mean the British government knows of the tunnel?
No, it doesn't. No, I've sent letters to every prime minister since MacDonald, telling them about it. Charts, diagrams, descriptions. Useless. They think I'm a crank. I can't blame them. What would Mr. Eisenhower say if you told him there's a tunnel between London and New York? You see what I mean? I got acknowledgement just once. A CID man came around and blabbed the whole story to everyone. Told him to keep an eye on me as a dangerous lunatic. The only way to protect the secret after that was to ride it like a mania, so I told everyone, too. Best security measure ever devised. Now, however, there are three of us who really know about the tunnel. It's awkward. I don't know what to do.
Oh, I can tell you exactly. You're going to take me back to Calais and now, otherwise I'll beat you to a pulp. I ought to anyway, making me doubt myself as you did.
Taking you into the tunnel. That might be the best way.
We'd never tell anyone, I swear it.
Here. I don't want you to see the entrance and exit, though. You'll have to wear blindfolds.
Agreed.
Now, let's get going, then. Yes, taking you into the tunnel is the best way.
Say, how much longer before we're in the tunnel?
You can take off the blindfolds now. We're in it.
How wonderful.
The tunnel? Yes, they did a fine job, the Sixth Corps. Fat lot they got for it. Boney flung them in the Russian campaign when they'd finished, and sort of it they all died. Best way of keeping a secret, eh?
How did you learn of it?
Reading in the British Museum. I was broke and unemployed. I found an old diary by one of the engineers. Investigated and found it was true. I wrote to the government, told them about that. Well, it was too good to let it waste, so I set up a small import-export business. Cheaper transportation gives me an edge on my competitors.
Are we in Calais?
Well, no, but it's as far as you go. I've got to kill you. I can't let you live. It's too dangerous now that you know. The shotgun failed me twice today. Perhaps the revolver.
Oh.
Get out of the truck, please. Unless you want your blood all over the young lady, please get
up. All right.
Now, perhaps... Well, I won't think you cowardly if you turn your back.
Listen...
Oh, come now, no temporizing, just take it. Yep! Oh, dash it all.
Emily?
I think I'm going to faint.
Help me get him back into the truck, huh?
Just let me sit here for a moment.
Yeah.
David?
Huh?
We'll tell the authorities the truth about the tunnel and all.
Uh-huh.
Everyone ought to know.
Yeah.
It's too good a thing and makes travel and trade and communication so simple. We've no right to keep it a secret.
Check. We'll tell the authorities. We came to the end of the tunnel at exactly 2 o'clock by Miss Haydock's watch. Time and to spare in order to board my ship. We left Mr. Smith Travers in the truck and made our way into what was apparently a small warehouse. And from there, through a door, we found ourselves on the corner of a street, much like any other street in Calais. A fog had rolled in since sunrise, as thick as the one we'd left in England. Oh, one moment. I want to make a note of this street, or we'll never find the tunnel again. Hey, you got a pencil?
Mm-mm.
Oh, never mind. I have one.
There's no street sign.
No, up there on the side of the building. They don't put them on lampposts like we do in the States. All right, I've got it. Say, when do you get back to the States?
September 1st. School term starts on the 10th. I teach kindergarten in Baltimore.
Oh, we're supposed to put in at Baltimore Christmas week.
Well, that's marvelous. We could have Christmas Eve together.
Yeah, New Year's too, maybe. I'll look forward to that.
You'll write, meanwhile, won't you?
Oh, of course. You know, I'll never be able to thank you enough for what you did. What made you believe in me so strongly?
Oh, I don't know. You see, what's the matter?
I'm not sure. We're walking toward the harbor. That's the trouble with a foreign city. You turn a corner and you're lost. And this dirty fog is so... Well, let's try this way.
Would that be a policeman in the doorway?
Where? Oh, yes. Yes, it is. Parlez anglais.
A little.
Which way is the harbor?
Turn at the next corner, to the left, and walk four streets.
Well, thank you, thank you. Oh, how do you pronounce the name of the street I've written here?
Street?
Yeah.
There's no street.
No street? Well, what does it say?
In English, this way to the air raid shelter. We have put them on almost every building in Calais.
Air raid shelter? Then we'll never be able to find our way back to the tunnel.
Eh?
Gendarme, are you sure?
But of course. As sure as I am that two and two make four.
Escape, produced and directed by David Friedkin and Morton Fine, has brought you Two and Two Make Four, a story by Walter Newman. Featured in the cast were Shep Mencken, Joyce McCluskey, Tudor Owen, and Richard Peel. Also heard were Betty Harford, Dick Ryan, Melissa Milo, and James Barrett. Your announcer, Bill Anders. The special music for Escape is composed and conducted by Leith Stevens. Next week.
You're on a catch sailing the coral seas, snaking your way through the tricky channel toward an island of black pearls. While on the shore, waiting for you to land, is the man who has sworn your death, and from whom there is no escape.
So listen next week when Escape brings you Robert Tallman's story, The King of Oahu. Stay tuned now for Night Watch, which follows immediately over most of these stations. America listens most to the CBS Radio Network.
Okay, that was a fun show. Two and two make four. As I was listening to this, I couldn't help but thinking that the lead character there, and I'm not sure which actor was playing that, but you'll know, but it could have been done by Jimmy Stewart. He had a very Jimmy Stewart-ish quality to his delivery, and also the writing is for that character. Just screamed Jimmy Stewart to me.
Yeah, well, kind of like The Man Who Knew Too Much or one of those Hitchcock
Right.
thrillers.
Right, right.
Yeah.
No, but, that was fun.
That's Shep Mencken, the actor who played the lead.
Okay. Yeah, you said that earlier. Sorry, I missed that. But
I kept
hearing Jimmy Stewart every time he said something. It's like, oh, Jimmy Stewart's in this one, but okay. All right, well, very good. Keith Scott, that is the final of the 10 episodes that you've signed on for here. You got them all done. Is there anything you want to talk about this final Escape show before we move on and come back next week with something different? And you won't be here. It'll just be me.
It'll just be you. No, nothing particularly that we can add to that, except it just proves that right up to the final episode that the show was still maintaining a really high standard when a lot of people think radio was kind of being looked on as the poor cousin now, and nobody was really caring. Those people who still loved doing radio, like MacDonald and Elliot Lewis and that, never dropped their game, even when the figures and audience started dwindling.
Well, yeah, and you also, if you think about it, this is 1954, and William Conrad's on this. William Conrad, by that point, was a big star in radio as Matt Dillon on Gunsmoke, yeah. And here he is doing little bits on Escape.
That's right, and still right up until the second last episode, he was doing the opening voice, and Paul Frees did the very final one. So all of these guys were well employed elsewhere, because Conrad was also doing a lot of good character roles in movies at that time.
Right, and he couldn't have been making much money doing this. If they had no sponsor all these years, then most of unless they had a guest star, which I don't think they did, and not on the ones we've heard, but they're going to be paying these radio actors basically a scale or just a little bit above scale to do this.
No, it was proven confirmed by people I've heard on Spurback interviews, I think, like William Frug, who was by then an executive at CBS. He said all of these people were happy to take scale because the budgets had shrunk and shrunk. He said even the orchestras by 1954 were only like 6 or 7 pieces, whereas just 7 or 8 years before that, it was like a 25-piece orchestra. So and the technical crews were better than they ever were, because they used to have more sound effects guys, and then this particular one was done, I think, by some of the guys who did Gunsmoke. Tom Hanley and Ross Murray, I think, did the sound effects on that episode that we just heard. So, it was these people who just loved the medium they were in. I remember Elliot Lewis saying that, I think it was William Frug, that when it looked like TV had won conclusively, he said there were quite a few of us who just looked at each other and said, well, I'm sticking with radio. I prefer it. I don't even want to go into TV if I don't have to.
Well, Bill Frug, or William Frug, wound up as a professor at UCLA in his later years.
Right, exactly. And he was a great source of knowledge about how the Hollywood radio industry worked. I hear that his book is very good. I don't have a copy of it, but I'm going to get it eventually.
Yeah, I don't have that either. But he went on to, shortly after this, produce a lot of the CBS Radio Workshops, which is another outstanding series. They were doing outstanding quality stuff on that show.
That's right. And then after Bill Robeson had been in trouble with the Red Channels book, which was a big mistake because he wasn't even the person that it was guilty as charged. They had made a mistake and put because he was named the same as his father, the Red Channels people were referring to his long gone father as the person who'd been involved in some left wing activity, and they had to finally eat humble pie and say, yeah, we screwed up, and sorry we interrupted your career for several years.
Sorry.
But Bill Frug brought him back to CBS just as the final executive had left, who was in charge of all of that red baiting stuff, and started him back again in radio on that CBS Radio Workshop. And he said that was a show that Conrad and all these guys just worked for scale. But he said the budgets in those days for radio had shrunk so markedly that Bill Conrad played the lead in Gunsmoke as a labor of love for those 9 years, because even as the lead in that show, he said they think he was making a fortune. He wasn't. He was getting $500, just per week.
Yeah.
Which I guess was good money in those days.
$500 a week back in the 50s was pretty good pay, but it wasn't the kind of pay that the TV people got. And of course, the movie stars, people, which got way more than that. So, you're down. When you were a radio actor in 1954, 55, you're way down the ladder, but you're still multiple notches above most people's incomes at that time.
Oh, sure, yeah. But most of the radio people by 54 had started taking advantage of TV in one sense, because suddenly there were all these visual commercials that needed voiceovers, and that began the era of where they got residuals for doing TV commercials, and that really sustained them financially.
All right. Well, I'm gonna stop here because you just mentioned something, the voiceover thing. You've been with us for 10 episodes now, and not one of them did we specifically mention or plug your Cartoon Voices book. So,
thank you.
I'm going to sit back here and let you tell us about your Cartoon Voices book and where people can get it, because I think if the listeners here have stuck with us for these 10 episodes and heard you give us all this fabulous information and background information on all these people for 10 episodes, the very least they could do is buy your book.
Well,
even though it has nothing to do with this per se, but tell us about your book.
Well, it's related only because so many of the people who did Cartoon Voices that are in this book that I wrote were also radio actors, especially on the West Coast. And this book that I've written was published about a year ago. And for people who are unaware of it and who are interested in the topic of all of the great uncredited cartoon voice actors of the theatrical cartoon era. I'm talking like the beginning of sound film, roughly 1930 to 1970. There were hundreds and hundreds of cartoons in the theaters that eventually ended up being replayed on television. And we really only know about Mel Blanc because sometime in 1944, he started getting a credit on screen voice characterizations. And none of the others did in those pre-television days. It was really only when television came along with Hanna-Barbera productions that voice actors per se began getting screen credit quite prominently. A separate title card, I think, began with Huckleberry Hound in 1958, Dorse Butler, Don Messick. Just says voice, you know. Until then, the previous 30 years, 99% of the people who did the voices in these films did not get a screen credit. It was just policy back then that they fell into the same area as the anonymous radio actor or the anonymous session singers who did so much dubbing in Hollywood films for people who couldn't sing. So I wrote this book called Cartoon Voices of the Golden Age, 1930 to 70, and it's available I think it's mostly available now by sites like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. I think the publisher is a small press publisher. Ben Omart has a company called Bear Manor Media, but I think he prefers really that it's easier for people simply to order them on sites like Amazon or Barnes & Noble because they're print on demand. All of the things these days are so different from the way books used to be published. So if the order goes in, his print company is contacted automatically and they just run off copies. And I have heard that some people have ordered and had them within 48 hours, even though when they first order, they're not printed. That is basically where you get it. Amazon, the usual suspects, and it's a two-volume set. The first volume is the history of Warner Brothers cartoons and MGM, like Tom and Jerry and all of those, Walt Disney, Walter Lantz, all the famous cartoon studios in detail, and a history of how the voices developed at each studio. And the second volume is a list of all the cartoons by each of those studios with voice credits where known. I mean, you know, there are still some unsolved mysteries in such a gigantic topic, but as much information has been found over the years at studio archives as far-flung as UCLA and USC and the Public Library of Billy Rose Theatre Collection in New York City, you know, all of this research done by whenever I could afford to fly over. The book still hadn't been finished when COVID hit, and a lot of people in the animation buff field were saying, when's this book of yours ever going to be published? And finally, you know, when the pandemic happened, I thought, right, well, I'm going to finish this book up because I can't travel overseas now, you know, and finish any final research. So people are going to have to just take all of my research as it is at the moment, which is pretty extensive. I mean, there's discoveries of at least 150 confirmed people who never had screen credit before, and most of them did many, many cartoons each. So it's really whittled the field down now. So that's that book, and they can also, if they're fans of the great Jay Ward cartoons, Rocky and Bullwinkle, George of the Jungle, Dudley Do-Right, which have all of these great escape actors in them, Paul Frees, William Conrad, Hans Conried. They can also see my earlier book called The Moose That Roared, which is a history of the J. Ward Cartoon Studio and covers that in great detail.
Well, great. So you've got two books out there.
End of plug.
Okay. But you needed to do that because you've spent a lot of time with us. You've given us a lot of great information. It's been
Thank you. Very entertaining
and fun to have you on the Good Old Days of Radio Show. And we appreciate our guests very much. And we want to give them every opportunity to reach out to our
audience
and sell them a book or something. And you write good books just like you give good information here. So anybody that's listened to this series now and heard this, and you did one with us a few months back as well on the Cartoon Voices.
Yes.
If you have interest in that, get Mr. Scott's book. You got to have it. It's going to really help you out, and it's a fun read, and he writes as entertaining as he speaks. So,
thank you kindly, and it is always a pleasure to do this podcast. It's a high quality podcast, and I'm a great booster of it. So, I look forward to a future engagement when we have another themed topic, whether it's Escape Revisited or some other great series.
Okay, well, we'll come up with something. We'll come up with something.
Yeah. Like
plenty more radio shows. Well, Keith Scott, thank you so much for all your time, all the way from Australia, time differences and all the rest of it. We made it work. We got 10 episodes done.
Yep.
And thank you so much.
We did.
And we will speak to you again. This is John Tefteller in the Good Old Days of Radio Show saying goodbye.
Bye-bye.